More hot weather in southern Europe has got people desperately seeking relief and air conditioner installers.
It's a nighttime. It becomes the hardest. You know, you're trying to sleep without aircon. It just doesn't cool down. We're still in 30 degree heat.
That's 86 degrees Fahrenheit, not ideal sleeping weather. Also today, the Moomins. These children's books from Finland have been huge since the 50s. Walt Disney wanted to buy the franchise from the author.
But she said no. She wanted to keep it for herself. You know, she wanted her freedom.
7 decades later, the Moomins have arrived in the U.S. Plus, the Commonwealth Games are on ice. Officials in Australia say they're not worth the cost.
Frankly, $6 to $7 billion for a 12-day sporting event. We are not doing that.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. The U.S. and China are talking climate again. U.S. climate envoy John Kerry is wrapping up a 4-day visit to the Chinese capital today.
We came to Beijing in order to unstick what has been stuck since almost last August.
Kerry was the third top Biden administration official to travel to China recently after the two sides cut off most high-level contact last summer. Kerry was clear that no new ground was broken in conversations between the world's two biggest climate polluters on this visit, but the U.S. and China have agreed to restart regular talks about climate change in upcoming weeks.
These conversations are going to be fairly intense because we are trying to break new ground, and that's hard. But if we don't break new ground, it's going to be even harder to tame the monster that has been created in terms of the climate crisis.
U.S. and Chinese cooperation will be crucial for moving the world further along combating climate change. The two countries emit about 40% of the globe's planet warming pollution. Kerry says he and his Chinese counterparts agreed to work together at upcoming international meetings, including the UN's climate summit this fall, COP28. The two sides will also soon discuss how to reduce methane emissions and scaling up renewable energy in China, which is still building new coal-fired power plants, which emit a lot of greenhouse gases.
China has built new coal plants because of the demands of their economy and the demand of their population and their absence of oil and gas. And yet we believe there are other alternatives, and we're trying to work with China to figure out the path ahead.
But political tension is still alive. During Kerry's visit, Chinese President Xi Jinping said in a speech to environmental officials that the pathway and pace of decarbonization in his country, quote, must be determined by ourselves and never under the sway of others. Kerry, for his part, says his Chinese counterparts did not say that to him.
We had extremely warm and productive meetings with very high-level officials, none of whom expressed that kind of concern.
The meetings happened as the impacts of climate change were being felt across the globe. In Greece, temperatures are expected to reach 111 Fahrenheit by the end of the week. New evacuation orders were issued today as wildfires rage near Athens. Firefighters in southern Greece are battling two major fires fanned by strong winds, with flames creeping dangerously close to summer resort towns. Chris Field, a Stanford climate expert, says these kinds of heat events have many significant impacts on quality of life.
We're really struggling to get a handle on the overall consequences for public health, especially when you've got a heat event that's also got wildfire smoke or a heat event that also has a power failure.
This kind of heat can be deadly. It's also been a boon to some businesses like air conditioning installers. Clifford Savage is the owner of Cool Breeze Air Conditioning on Spain's southern coast. He joins us from Marbella, Spain. What is the weather like now where you are on the Costa del Sol in southern Spain, Clifford?
Today is 41 degrees in Malaga and about 39 degrees in Marbella where we are at the minute. Yeah, quite warm.
Yeah, so that's well into the triple digits Fahrenheit. So your company, yeah. Cool Breeze Air Conditioning, you install, you maintain and repair air conditioners. What's business been like this season and in recent years?
This year, we are definitely installing probably double the amount of air conditioning units that we normally would install for this time of year. And we're repairing a record amount of aircon units at the moment. I'm working from 8 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night. 7 days a week trying to keep everybody happy.
So you're saying you've doubled the numbers of air conditioning installs this year since last year?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, we've normally only employed two staff that would do the installs. And this year we've doubled that to four members of staff that are flat out doing installs 7 days a week.
That's kind of stunning. I mean, how do you manage to do that?
Well, we just went to the local college and employed a couple of extra people from the college that had just passed our exams about 5 months ago. I had a pretty good idea it was going to be getting hot this year and a bit more busy, but I didn't quite expect it to be quite as hot and quite as busy.
Yeah, so when you say didn't expect it to be quite as hot, there is a code red heat warning for towns on the Costa del Sol today. What does that mean?
It's pretty hard to work. In fact, one of our employees actually rung us half an hour ago and said that he's feeling quite ill and asked if he could go home today because they're working inside a plant room and it's probably 50 Celsius inside the plant room at the moment.
50 Celsius, that's 122 Fahrenheit.
So yeah, we've allowed him to go home, obviously. Can't have anyone being ill on the job. We're all drinking plenty of water and trying to keep as hydrated as possible while working.
This code red heat warning, though, how common is this on the coast of Spain?
So yeah, every year we get a code red. It's normally in August and it's normally only for a few days. This has been 2 weeks now, maybe even 2.5 weeks now that we've been super hot and a month earlier than normal.
And what does the fact that you're installing double the number of ACs this summer compared to last summer, what does that tell you about how people are coping?
Everyone's desperate. Everyone that rings us is, you know, please come today, you know, and help us out because they just can't handle the heat, especially the older people as well. I've had customers ring me and say, you know, not had air conditioning for the last 4 or 5 years because the old one broke, but please come and install aircon for us now because we just can't take it anymore. It's the nighttime and it becomes the hardest, you know, trying to sleep without aircon because of the mosquitoes and things like that. Everyone shuts all their windows and doors, but at nighttime, it just doesn't cool down.
I mean, a lot of people are talking about the latest heat waves in the context of global warming. If more people are using air conditioning units, that obviously is going to increase the amount of carbon emissions. I know the new AC systems are more energy efficient, but how efficient are we talking about?
So the new inverter type units are roughly about a third of the cost to run and power compared to the old on-off systems, simply because the old on-off, the motor used to stop, and the new inverters, the motor just slows down. So they are a lot cheaper to run and obviously a lot better for the environment.
So Clifford, you know, beyond the advances in air conditioning technology, is there just a smarter way to use AC to lower the energy bill and lower our emissions at the same time?
Yeah, so in Spain as well, for commercial buildings, they will not allow you to set the temperature below 27 Celsius.
80 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, obviously, the higher the temperature you have, the less energy it's going to use to make that happen. And they did that again for an environmental reason.
So people in Marbella who don't have air conditioning right now, how do they get by? Are there any local solutions that work for them that you've seen?
You see a lot of Spanish women still walking around fanning themselves with the old style paper fans inside the street. And that's still quite common here. And lots of older houses are built with a very high part of the house in the center. And obviously heat rising, you have the windows open up there and the windows open downstairs where you're living. And that draws air through, even if there's no actual wind, it creates a natural draft running through the house. But obviously the air you're bringing in is still 40 degree air. If that's what's outside, that's still what you're bringing in. But yeah, just to have some air running past you is nice.
Clifford, you're originally from the UK. How long have you been living in Spain and working in the AC installation business?
So yeah, I've been AC back in the UK as well before I moved here. And I've been living in Spain for 20 years.
And why did you move to Spain?
I moved for the sunny weather.
Yeah, now it's really sunny. Any regrets?
Yeah, just a little bit. No, definitely not. No, I love living in Spain. It's really nice. Yeah, different way of life completely to the UK.
We've been speaking with Clifford Savage. He's the owner of Cool Breeze Air Conditioning in Marbella in southern Spain. The country is in the middle of a serious heat wave like many places across southern Europe. Clifford, thank you for taking the time and stay cool.
Thank you.
Since the end of Title 42, the policy which allowed U.S. immigration officials to turn away migrants without a chance for asylum, the number of unauthorized crossings has dropped to the lowest level in 2 years. A new appointment system has taken pressure off U.S. ports of entry. Elisa Resnick of KJZZ in Nogales, Mexico, explains what things look like for some migrants south of the border.
By the time Title 42 came to a close on May 11th, Angela, an asylum seeker from Venezuela, was already on the road. We're not using her full name because she's worried it will affect her asylum case in the U.S. We walked through almost all of Central America, she says. I met her and her husband at the Kino Border Initiative, an aid center for migrants in Nogales, Sonora. They've been through 11 countries to get here. She says they can't go back to Venezuela because her husband abandoned his military service when he objected to government actions there. They were living in Chile, but it kept getting more expensive to survive. Getting asylum?
In esos países no es muy raro que te den asilo.
Getting asylum is very rare in those countries, she says. So back in April, she and her husband set out for the U.S. and sent their 5-year-old daughter to live with her grandmother.
Porque yo no me atrevía a pasarla por la selva del Darién, pero...
I didn't dare take her through the Darién Gap, Ángela says. That's the land bridge connecting South and Central America. It's a roadless, deadly stretch of jungle many migrants are using to get to the U.S.-Mexico border. She's tearing up talking about it now.
O sea, y puedo que hasta llore ahorita de que la extraño y todo, pero... No le ibas poner, ¿no?
I miss her, Ángela says, but I couldn't expose her to that. She and her husband came to Nogales because it's where they managed to secure a CBP-1 appointment. Customs Border Protection rolled out the smartphone app earlier this year. Asylum seekers can use it to make appointments with border officers at a handful of ports border-wide. Approaching the port like this, as an asylum seeker, was nearly impossible under Title 42 because the protocol allowed border officers to turn most away on public health grounds. Rights advocates hope for a shift when the protocol ended. Instead, Pedro de Velasco, with the Kino Border Initiative, says families in Nogales are finding more confusion.
It's until they arrive here that they learn that they cannot simply approach the port of entry and request admission because there's a wait line.
Thousands of asylum seekers now vie for one of 1,450 CBP appointments allotted border-wide each day. De Velasco says it can take months to secure an appointment, and many in Nogales can't afford to wait.
They're hoping that they're able to secure an appointment through CBP-1 app. But in the meantime, I mean, they don't feel safe waiting here in Mexico. Most of the folks that we are serving, they're actually Mexican nationals that are fleeing violence and persecution, and they're forced to wait in the same country that they're trying to flee.
Asylum seekers are now lining up at the port of entry here without CBP-1 appointments, hoping to explain their situation. Some are sleeping here for days or even more than a week. Municipal authorities in Nogales started a second wait list for them. De Velasco says it's about 300 people long right now. Only a few families from that list are seen each day.
The border is just one of the steps for people getting to where they want to go. And we are creating this bottleneck.
A report released this month by the advocacy group Human Rights First found that asylum seekers have been subject to violent attacks like rape, kidnapping, and other assaults by organized crime while waiting for CBP-1 appointments. Meanwhile, asylum seekers who don't use the app face a higher threshold for getting to stay in the U.S. They have to prove that they tried to get protection in another country first and were denied. Christina Asensio with Human Rights First says her team found many families were unaware of the new policies altogether.
People are driven to desperation to try to seek safety.
De Velasco says even those who manage to secure CBP-1 appointments, like Ángela and her husband, face an uncertain future if and when they make it to the U.S.
Eso fue cuando cumplió ahorita 5 años.
In a picture Ángela has of her daughter, she's in a baby blue dress and has a bushel of black curly hair just like her mom. She hopes to get asylum in the U.S. and eventually bring her daughter to join them. On phone calls, she says her daughter asks why they came.
O sea, cosas que ella no entiende, ¿no? Que todo lo hago es por ella y ya más adelante ella se dará cuenta todo el sacrificio que estamos haciendo.
Those are things she doesn't understand, Ángela says. Everything I do is for her. And later on, she'll realize all the sacrifices we're making. For the world, I'm Elisa Resnick in Nogales, Mexico.
Clumsy typing has led to mix-ups in emails. Instead of going to the U.S. military, they end up in West Africa in Mali. One guy in the Netherlands has been trying to call attention to the problem.
I actually didn't believe him because it was so kind of ridiculous.
We'll explain just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Today in Kenya, a 3-day protest began against the government. People are angry about the rising cost of living. At times, the protests have turned violent. Human rights groups say police killed several people in similar protests last week. The World's Halima Gikande reports from Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
The streets of much of Nairobi today were quiet. Schools were ordered to close down, businesses closed their doors, and many people opted to just stay home to avoid being caught in these protests. But in pockets of this city and others around the country, people were out on the streets. These are the latest protests organized by Kenya's main opposition leader, Raila Odinga, a stalwart of Kenyan politics who ran and lost in last year's presidential election. He and his party say these demonstrations are about the rising cost of living and a new unpopular finance bill that will raise taxes for Kenyans at a difficult time.
People are tired of going to bed hungry, facing the new day hungry, and returning to bed hungry.
Odinga's party and its supporters are also saying that President William Ruto, who took office less than a year ago, is illegitimate. That's led the president to suggest that these demonstrations are all about politics. I want to ask them, will this hunger be ended by protests? The president said to a crowd over the weekend. Will destroying people's property end hunger? President Ruto is accusing the opposition of using the right to protest as an opportunity to cause mayhem. Regardless, the issues being raised in these demonstrations are very real for Kenyans. Many people in this country are struggling to put food on the table. In the working-class neighborhood of Jericho, I meet Moses Shalicia. He's a boxing coach here. The conditions of life are very bad across the country, he tells me. Although he said he wouldn't be participating in protests today, he still supports them because the right to protest is in Kenya's constitution. That right is being stifled by Kenya's police, according to human rights groups. They say security forces have fired tear gas and live bullets that have killed civilians. Last week, a young boxer from this neighborhood named Rafael Shigali was one such victim. According to local reports, he was shot when passing by a demonstration. Moses Shalicia says he had known Shigali since he was young and taught him boxing. He was a good and generous person and a talented up-and-coming boxer, he says. On Tuesday, the community held a boxing event in Shigali's honor. In a big ring outside, young boxers trade punches to a cheering crowd. Behind them are posters that read, "Shine on your way, champ." R.I.P. Getting money these days is hard, Shalicia tells me. This event will help raise money for Shigali's family and for his funeral arrangements. In the political debate around the ongoing demonstrations, this is the real human cost. Shalicia tells me protesters should be peaceful and the police should stop using live ammunition against unarmed demonstrators. More protests are planned for Thursday and Friday. Kenya's religious leaders are calling for a dialogue between the rival political camps. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Ever hit send on an email only to later realize you misspelled the email address? A lot of members of the U.S. military have been doing this and mistakenly sending emails to one country in West Africa. Mistype the U.S. military email address domain that ends with .mil, and instead you write .ml, and that email is going to end up in the African nation of Mali. In this case, it means potentially sensitive military information is going to the wrong people. Reporter Jacob Judah wrote about this in the Financial Times. Jacob, who discovered this was going on?
So Mali's internet domain has been managed for 10 years by a Dutch entrepreneur by the name of Johannes Zurbier. And when he took over Mali's domain in 2013, he noticed that there was lots of requests coming in for websites that didn't exist, like army.ml. And he sort of went into the back end and realized that what these were emails that were being misdirected by US servicemen and servicewomen. The problem is that from Monday, his contract ends with the Malian government, and the Malian government, which has a very close relationship with Russia, will be able to collect these hundreds of thousands of emails that have been misdirected.
That's kind of stunning. I mean, is it typical that a person in a country like the Netherlands will manage the domain for a country like Mali?
Yes, it is. So every country in the world has digital territory. The UK has .uk, France has .fr, Canada .ca. And most countries like Mali, who are less well-developed, they will tender out sort of the back end.
So how did Johannes Zerbier in the Netherlands figure this out?
He figured it out in 2013 when he took over. And that's when he realized that there were lots of requests. And there was lots of traffic that was coming in that was bouncing simply because people were sending emails to emails in Mali that didn't exist. At that point, what he did is he got legal advice to make sure that he wouldn't be breaking any laws by trying to check to see what this was. And then sort of twice in the past decade, for 3 days, he set up a little email to basically collect, just to see what's there.
So just in those two times, in that short window, he was able to kind of like see a whole bunch of problems.
Yes.
So describe for us some of the most eye-popping, worrying emails that you saw.
So the most concerning was then forthcoming visit by the chief of staff of the US Army, General James Acconville, to Jakarta. He was staying at a hotel there, and this hotel had misaddressed his room number and the room numbers for his entire entourage, as well as details of how to collect his key and when he would be checking in and checking out. You know, there were others. For example, one FBI agent had forwarded themselves six very sensitive documents, one of which was a Turkish diplomatic cable about activities by the Kurdish PKK in the United States. Another one was about Iranian espionage in the United States. But, you know, it's really anything you can imagine.
As mistakes go, I mean, Mali is a really interesting one. There's been years of jihadist activity there. The U.S. has had a military presence. The French recently left, basically told to leave by the Malian government. And now Wagner Group mercenaries are there. At some point, did Zerbier let the Pentagon know about this?
Yes. He's done this repeatedly. So one of his attempts to raise the alarm included joining a trade mission with the Dutch Prime Minister in 2014 to try and enlist the help of Dutch diplomats in Washington. He was able to speak to people from the Department of Defense, people in the White House, who went, wow, and then nothing happened. In 2015, he made a further effort to alert U.S. authorities, again to no avail. He also sent emails to the military attaché in Bamako and to the Department of Defense itself. But, you know, unfortunately for him and unfortunately for the Pentagon, none of this was taken seriously enough to try and stop it.
Has the Pentagon responded to your reporting?
So the Pentagon did provide us with a comment saying that, you know, this was a very serious issue. There was not a lot that they can do if, as in most of these cases, the emails are coming from outside contractors and people outside of the Department of Defense who are trying to send an email in.
Jacob Judah is a reporter in the UK. He reported a story for the Financial Times about U.S. military emails getting sent to Mali's internet domain by accident. Jacob, what a crazy story. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
You're with the world. An Israeli rapper who grew up in a conservative working-class neighborhood in Jerusalem flows his lyrics between Hebrew and Arabic, expressing a progressive vision for his country. He's hoping Israelis and Palestinians will learn both languages.
Yo, it doesn't matter which side of the conflict you are, you need to learn to speak with the other side.
Finding common ground through hip-hop, ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Commonwealth Games are one of those every 4 year sporting events that bring together athletes from across the globe. In this case, athletes from countries within the British Commonwealth. They're a big deal to the people and countries that take part. But the future of the Games is now in doubt. This week, the Australian state of Victoria announced it was pulling out of its commitment to host the next Commonwealth Games, scheduled for 2026. Victoria's Premier Daniel Andrews put sentimentality aside when he made the announcement.
Look, I've made a lot of difficult calls, a lot of very difficult decisions in this job. This is not one of them.
Andrews said the high cost of hosting the Games was not good value for money.
Frankly, $6 to $7 billion for a 12-day sporting event, we are not doing that.
So what happens now? We decided to get in touch with someone in a country affected by this turn of events. Robert Livingstone is a Canadian journalist and creator of GamesBids.com. Robert, was this news of the Australian state of Victoria bowing out of hosting the 2026 Commonwealth Games, was it a surprise?
Absolutely. It was quite a shock. And I think it was a surprise to many of the stakeholders. It just came out very quickly. You know, Victoria put up their hand. They ran unopposed last year and nobody saw this coming.
So will there be another city or country stepping in to host the Games? I mean, what's the latest on that?
Well, there are other cities. I mean, it's only been hours, but other cities that have said that they're willing to step in, a city in India that's preparing or looking forward to bidding for the Olympics. They're thinking about it. London, the London mayor said they're ready to use their Olympic legacy from 2012 to stage the games on short notice. But that's a real issue. What cities can do this with only 3 years when typically they get 6 or 7 years?
Yeah, so a really big surprise. What have you heard across Canada in athletic circles?
Also a surprise and disappointment because athletes are already preparing, you know, for that date, even though it's 3 years out. The cities of Calgary and Edmonton in Alberta are looking at bidding possibly for 2030. That's the centennial event of the Commonwealth Games. And they have to think about whether they could step in for 26. Really short notice, a lot of extra risk. So they probably, you know, I've spoken to a few people and it doesn't look like it's going to be feasible. But there are cities, there's countries that want to host the future games, just maybe not this way, this quickly.
So as we heard a moment ago, Daniel Andrews, the premier of the Australian state of Victoria, he was withering in his denunciation of the cost of hosting the games, estimates of $6 to $7 billion, and he was not going to take money out of hospitals and schools in order to fund it. Had the Commonwealth Games just become too expensive to make it worth it?
You know what? I think this case is an anomaly. I don't see why those games are going to cost $6 or $7 billion. There is a lot of scope creep there where they've added projects against the suggestions of Commonwealth Games Federation, who want to keep these things, want to keep these games light. They want cities and regions to use facilities that already exist. You know, we just saw Birmingham host those games last year. Very successful. They didn't cost that much.
Birmingham, UK.
Yeah, yeah. And they were successful. Didn't cost anywhere near as much. I don't have that price tag for you, but it was lower. And they're one of those cities that say, hey, maybe we'll do it in 26 because we have fresh legacy.
What kind of creep did you call the rise in cost?
Scope creep, doing more than they really need to do. You know, with existing facilities, and in Melbourne, there were a lot of existing facilities to host the events that are on the schedule. And the other thing about the Commonwealth Games that make them different from the Olympics is there's a lot of flexibility. So the sports vary depending on where they're hosted. So in Victoria, they're going to be hosting sports that are used in Australia. So they have facilities. They have the cricket pitch. They don't need to build a special venue to host. So there's a lot of opportunity to keep those costs low. Why it went up to $6 or $7 billion Australian dollars is kind of a puzzle.
Well, Robert, you're Canadian, and notably Canada hosted the first Commonwealth Games. You mentioned the centennial coming up in 2030. In 1930, they were called the British Empire Games. How and why did this event get started?
Well, it's obviously the Commonwealth, and well, the British Empire back then has those colonial roots, right? So it was a way of trying to bring together the member nations and, you know, have this kind of sports festival that were different than the Olympics and different from some of the other events. They didn't happen during World War II, which is right after that, but then they came on strong since then, and they've become very popular. And although the Commonwealth itself has become less relevant than it was, that's the trend. That's the direction it's going with the death of Queen Elizabeth. Commonwealth is definitely changing. But the games have kind of taken on a character of their own. And, you know, as I mentioned, they're very well liked within the nations that participate.
How does it feel to you as a fan when you watch those opening moments of the Commonwealth Games and the athletes marching out?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting. And I don't think it's anchored to the Commonwealth at all. I think these games, they've adapted their own identity. So it's just seeing the thrill of being represented, having your nation march out. You know, there's 70 or so Commonwealth nations that participate, different than the Olympics where you see 200 countries. It's smaller. It's a feel. I'm trying to describe it. Countries that are able to host this event probably wouldn't be able to host an Olympic Games and a bigger team as well. So athletes that can qualify for the Commonwealth Games may not be able to qualify for an Olympic Games. And they're going to win more medals because there's less nations. They might not get that opportunity in an Olympic Games. So I think it's more of a sense of involvement and more of a sense of opportunity and, I guess, belonging, perhaps.
Robert Livingstone is a Canadian journalist and creator of GamesBids.com. He's been speaking to us from Toronto. Robert, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Ever heard of a Moomin? Your answer will depend on where you live or have lived. Moomins are rotund, fictional story characters from Finland. People in Europe and East Asia will be familiar with them. Not many Americans in the Moomins' huge fan base, though, but that may be changing. As reporter Will Coley in New York found out, folks in the U.S. are starting to discover the joy of Moomins.
This spring, I went to the Children's Storytime at a Barnes & Noble bookstore in Manhattan.
Hi, everyone. So I'll be reading a couple Moomin-themed stories at the children's stage in just a minute.
Despite the announcement, only two kids and two adults showed up.
So I'm going to go ahead and read. This is the book about Moomin, Mimble, and Little Mai by Tove Janssen. The sun shines down on fields of flowers. Moomin trolls walked for hours and hours.
Tove Janssen was a Swedish-speaking Finnish author who in 1945 published her first book about the adventures of a family of Moomins and their friends. She continued to write and created a series of 9 illustrated chapter books. From there, Janssen created a syndicated comic strip that was published in newspapers across 100 countries. There were 2 animated TV series and a movie.
The Riviera, how glamorous.
Casinos, gambling, music.
Why can't we go to the Riviera?
There's even a Moomin theme park in Japan. The company Janssen founded, Moomin Characters Limited, is now worth over $700 million. In the last decade, the value of the Moomin brand has increased more than 1,000%. This year, in partnership with Moomin Characters Limited, Barnes & Noble set out to change this. They created pop-up displays to introduce Americans to the Moomins and their neighbors in Moomin Valley. Creatures like Little Mai, Snufkin, the Hatafatners, Himulans, and the Grok.
Hi. I was just wondering, could you tell me where the Moomin display is, the Moomin books?
Where the what is?
Moomin books.
I visited the same store with Tove Janssen's biographer and friend, Bole Westin, to understand what this campaign would have meant to Janssen, who died in 2001.
Oh, well, here they are.
Willie Westin is a professor at the University of Stockholm. She says Janssen's books focused on the values of adventure, family, and tolerance. We discussed this outside, sitting in Union Square.
It's quite a traditional family, but there are also a lot of other people living in the Moomin house. Sometimes Moomin, he brings his friends, and they're welcome to stay, and they're quite tolerant also. So you can be yourself.
Janssen wanted to bring the Moomins to America from the beginning, but she didn't have the contacts at the time.
Later on in the mid-50s, when she had made a comic strip, it became quite world famous. And then Walt Disney wanted to buy the rights, but she said no. She wanted to keep it for herself, and she wanted her freedom.
Janssen was first and foremost an artist and among the first generation of liberated Finnish women. Janssen was also openly bisexual. Moomin fan Devin Dunn sees this in the books.
I do think that anything where there's sort of a found family or a collection of misfits is always going to resonate with queer readers.
Dunn works in an uptown independent bookstore called Book Culture. She frequently recommends the books to families looking for a new series to explore. She says they're just a little scary, but nothing terrible happens.
You know, the first one is that a comet is coming and they're all sort of terrified. Is it going to hit Moomin Valley? And, you know, a lot of it is processing your anxiety over things that you don't fully understand, which is a very helpful lesson for children and for adults as well.
With all this in mind, I try my own focus group with my 10-year-old second cousin in North Carolina, Zachary Thomas. I tell him the plot of the book, Moomin Summer Madness.
A tsunami? That is really serious. Much more serious than ever before.
I asked Zachary if he thought there was something about the books that might make them attractive to American kids.
It might love magical stories, especially in Moomin Troll.
But Zachary thinks there should be more conflict in the books. He invents a neighboring valley called Ugga.
It has the enemies and all those bad guys everywhere.
So do you think that's going to make the books really good if there's a big fight in it?
I think so, because older kids might like it because they love fighting, especially me.
The Moomin Characters Company reports an uptick in interest in the U.S. this summer, but it remains to be seen if Moomins become part of American families like they are in other countries. For The World, I'm Will Coley in New York City.
Nashville, Tennessee, and the city of Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan region of Iraq. A partnership 10 years in the making is now just about official. They're formalizing a relationship as sister cities. Erbil would become Nashville's 10th sister, a designation that involves travel and cultural and professional exchanges. Catherine Cece's at WPLN in Nashville reports on its ties to cities across the globe and this newest connection with Erbil.
A semicircle of women in blue sparkling dresses and men in cream outfits waving blue flags join hands and begin to dance.
Again, we're at a reception to honor our visit here, put on by many, many dignitaries and organizations here in Erbil who are hopeful about this partnership. And the dancing has started.
That's Sarah Lingo, the director of Nashville Sister Cities, making a cell phone video while traveling in Erbil, a city in the northwest part of Iraq. She was part of a delegation that attended a tea ceremony, visited schools and cultural sites, and had meals and meetings with Erbil residents and top officials.
We found Erbil to be incredibly safe, incredibly welcoming. Iraq doesn't have the best reputation here in the States for being safe. So just putting some of those things to rest, it's all part of our mission.
Sister Cities grew up out of the Cold War from President Eisenhower's belief in the power of citizen diplomats. Nashville connected with its first sister city, Edmonton, Canada, in 1991, and currently has 9 sisters, including Belfast, Northern Ireland, Kamakura, Japan, and Tamworth, Australia. 9 might seem like a lot, but it's not completely unusual. Portland, Oregon has 9, St. Louis has 15, and Houston has 19 sister cities. Adult exchanges tend to have a dozen or so travelers who stay with local families and spend 3 to 4 days exploring the city as a group. High school students can get their first experience abroad with sister cities. Unlike other student exchanges, before setting off, students go to the Davidson County Courthouse and are sworn in as official Nashville student ambassadors to the world.
If I could get the students to raise their right hand and then repeat after me.
William Watson took the oath before his first student exchange to Mendoza, Argentina, last year.
I will share the values.
I will share the values.
And culture of Nashville.
And the culture of Nashville.
And will respect the values.
And will respect the values.
And culture of my host city.
And culture of my host city.
The family he stayed with operated a tortilla factory. They had dinner every night with William and took him out to sightsee and for a weekend trip outside of the city.
You get to see how people in that country live in like an authentic way and not in a way where you're kind of a stranger in somebody's house. You really feel like you're part of the family, even if it is like a 2-week experience.
Traveling abroad is not the only way to get involved. Hosting visitors to Nashville and showing them favorite places around the city creates especially strong and sometimes lasting friendships. Valentina Boulin is a teacher in Mendoza who has helped with student exchanges to and from her city. She has now traveled to Nashville 5 times.
In my case, I'm always hosted by the same family, and they are my family now. Every time I travel there, I feel like I'm at home.
So with such established and active connections with 9 sister cities, why is a new partnership with Erbil in the mix? If you don't know, Nashville is home to over 25,000 Kurds who first started coming to the city from the Middle East in the 1970s to escape political turmoil or war. One Kurd who found a home in Nashville is Azad Samin. He and his family came here in 1996 to escape civil war. He was 14. After graduating from Tennessee State University with a degree in chemistry, he formed an organization to help Kurdish people adjust to life in Nashville.
In 2013, the idea of the sister city came into our mind. We proposed the idea to the Nashville sister city. They welcomed the idea. They loved it. Ever since, we have been working on this project. It's almost 10 years now.
A few years ago, he moved back to Erbil to continue the project from there. Outside of travel exchanges, sister city relationships can create specific professional partnerships.
Especially when it comes to medical, when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to agriculture. As you know, America is very advanced, and Nashville is very well known for that.
So one of the discoveries that we made while we were there was the potential for healthcare exchanges, bringing Kurdish doctors here to learn and sending American doctors there to learn and serve.
This is Sarah Lingo again. She has high hopes for this developing relationship.
I think Erbil can give Nashville something that no other sister city can really give us. I kind of have this hunch that it's going to be our most active relationship because you'll be able to take part in Kurdish celebrations here, meeting with the Kurdish diaspora here. You can fully immerse yourself into the Kurdish culture here.
In early September, Nashville will welcome a delegation from Erbil, including the governor, for a signing ceremony in Public Square, followed by citywide celebrations. With the mayor and governor's signatures, Nashville and Erbil, and all of their residents, will officially be able to call each other family. For The World, I'm Catherine Zeces, Nashville.
The New York Public Library is marking the birth of a cultural phenomenon born in the South Bronx 50 years ago. It's issuing new library cards celebrating the anniversary of hip-hop, featuring images of Brooklyn's very own Jay-Z and some iconic wild-style graffiti from the 1983 film of the same name. This summer, we've been bringing you a series of stories about how this art form rooted in Black American culture went global. The World's Matthew Bell caught up with one up-and-coming recording artist in Israel.
There's this great expression in Arabic, nus nus, translates as so-so, or half and half. It's also the title of a track by Noam Tsourieli. He's 28, from Jerusalem, and his debut album drops this summer.
כמה מילות פתיחה לפני שיתחיל הברדק זה שיר שונה, זה שיר מסע, תחזיקו חזק ברגעים שלא תבינו, תבינו זה המשחק יא אחוי, בת אם, אלינו ג'יבט כמוס ערבי מעק וואו עצור, שו עצור, עושיק עמניח תאורוס הלאה האדמה אחת עם שתי שפות יפות לאללה יש ערבית בביט, זה די קליט, הכל סבבה באו עייד, אינו בחקיש שנכתילל וואו נקבה, אם לא קצב לקחת
There are lots of songs with Hebrew and Arabic lyrics, but Tsourieli, who's a Jewish Israeli, says they usually miss the point because Hebrew speakers learn just the verses they understand, and the same for Arabic speakers. For Nus Nus, Noam Tsourieli says he's trying to pull off something different.
I wanted to make a song that you cannot ignore the other side, so I do a song that it's a line in Hebrew, a line in Arabic. Every line... And it's not a line in his translation, it's a line in the continuous of this line. So in that way, you can only understand half of the song if you don't understand the two languages. And this is the point of the song. If you don't understand both languages, you cannot understand fully what's happening in your own country. אם לא נדע לדבר, לא נפסיק פחד, לא נוכל חבר.
If we don't know how to talk, we won't stop being afraid, he raps. Some call me a dreamer. Not important. To hell with that. Tsourieli says he's faced some criticism for the track, with people attacking him online as a naive lefty. But he says he doesn't let it bother him.
It's not about taking sides. I'm not talking about is the Israeli side wrong or the Palestinian side wrong. This is not my job to... preach people what to believe. My job, I think, is to do good in this world. And for me, telling them, yo, it doesn't matter which side of the conflict you are, you need to learn to speak with the other side.
This is something that dawned on him during his mandatory army service. Tsourieli served in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, found himself face-to-face with Palestinian civilians, and realized that speaking to each other is the only way for these two nations to ever learn to live together. It's not his only song with a direct moral message. This tune is an ode to climate activist Greta Thunberg. Tsourieli says he finds her inspiring and engages in activism himself. But most of his music is not political at all. He sings and raps a lot about love, relationships, and heartbreak because he says that's just who he is.
Purim shuv igia, shuv shuvrim ta rosh, ech leitchapes kezug beketa tov, lo beketa nadosh, o she'enelech al keta pashut, ani ariya atatut, ani apoel, at makabi kvar nimtza ma lilbosh.
Hip-hop has been around for a while in Israel and the Palestinian territories, but in recent years it's really gone mainstream. Tsourieli says the thing that Israeli artists are bringing to the music is something captured by a Yiddish word. Tachlis means real or the heart of the matter.
Here in Israel, it's about just being honest to yourself, to your audience. It's not about fancy word or about some technique or trying to be in some formula. It's about being brutally honest, sometimes too brutal. But I think in our world, this is what the people want to hear.
Zuriele says he's wanted to be a rap star since sixth grade when he started listening to Eminem and A Tribe Called Quest. He also loves classic American soul, funk, and R&B. But one of his biggest musical influences is very close to home. That's Noam's father, Yinon Zuriele, playing a Bill Evans composition. He's sitting at the grand piano. They somehow managed to get up four flights of stairs and into the living room of the family's Jerusalem apartment.
Since I was 16, I built a jazz band, a sextet, with two saxophones, a trumpet, drums, a bass, and me.
Who was the leader of the sextet?
It was me.
Yinon can play, and he still does, as an amateur. Now, as Noam tries to get his career off the ground, Yinon reminds his son that the music business is not easy.
It's bigger now than it was 30 years or 50 years ago, but he's a big boy, and he knows that, and he's fighting to live his dream, or to make it true. Because I know that he's very talented, I believe in him.
This is a small country, but Israelis take their music pretty seriously. Zuriele tells me his goal is to one day be mentioned alongside the biggest selling hip-hop artists in Israel.
Now I want to be named, this is one of my targets, be named like there's Yes, there's Tuna, there's David Plotnik, and there's Noam Zuriele, like be in that conversation.
At a recent showcase for unsigned talent in the seaside town of Jaffa, he was the headliner, performing solo on piano and vocals. Noam Zuriele's forthcoming debut album is called in Hebrew Melim Lachan VeChazon, or Lyrics, Melody, and Vision. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Our series Planet Hip Hop has been bringing you the global sound of hip hop all summer long. Check out the playlists we put together, including music from across the Middle East and a lot of other places where hip hop is thriving. You can find that on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Tomorrow on the show, the best of the best of women's soccer take to the pitch as the World Cup kicks off in Australia. That'll mean there's some crazy early morning matches for viewers in the U.S., but we're masters of navigating global time zones in our newsroom, so count on us for the latest. Noos Noos plays us out today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.